Bonk.
Man.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
You were just looking suspiciously out the window of the Pizzone.
Wasn't suspicious. It was just ordinary looking.
Nothing weird out there?
Just a house.
Just a house? Okay, cool. Hey, the season, our first inaugural season is over.
The season of Croy.
The season of Croy. Puzzle Fighter first to 100. It has been going on since July or so.
Since we first got the cabinet. It was shortly after we got the cabinet. I remember there was some initial reluctance on my part to commit our scores, to our running scores, to a whiteboard or a tally of some kind, because when we first got the arcade cabinet, Dan was way better than I was at Puzzle Fighter, and I thought that, like, if we were to have a contest, then it would just be a total wash, so I didn't want to, you know, be met with a dependable source of discouragement every single day. So
to start
I was
the
reluctant.
Day. Yeah.
But then, you know, the more we played, it kind of got the hang of it a little more, and I was up for it.
I would say you definitely got the hang of it, because we see in my profile picture on Twitter, in the background, you can see the score, and that's on New Year's Eve, and it was 91-76 me. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about how you mounted a incredible comeback. Incredible, incredible. I think you won, like, you know, 23 out of 26 or something like that. Basically got it to 99.
And
we had the championship last night. Mm-hmm. And it was as close as you could imagine. It was the most dramatic possible ending of, you know, me getting way up, you know, late in the tournament or the season, you matching it 99-99. And it came down to the third of three rounds. Mm-hmm. And it was close. Every single round was close. And I eked it out.
Of course.
Hey, look, you had me sweating for a while there at the end. I do have the trophy. We have a custom trophy for this that I will hold.
And as part of the rules, the commission has determined that not only do you get the trophy, but you also get naming rights for the next season. And Daniel, would you like to share the name that you've chosen for the upcoming season?
Well, yes. The first season was the season of Croy, because we started it around the time that we had some birds that were growing. Hatching near our house, and one of them was named Croy, and that was the egg that did not hatch. So we named the first.
It was a memorial.
Yeah, we named all five eggs, and one of them was Croy, and it was so the season was Croy, as you said, as a memorial. I was not crying over the bird; I was burping right there. So I'm sad about the bird. I wish Croy would have made it, but he is time in memoriam because of the season. But this one, I was trying to think of something that was going on recently, and just as monumental as the birth of new life in this world, we got a rug in front of our dartboard, and it's got a snake on it. And so, to timestamp this season, it is the season of the serpent.
That's
is
right.
Season two of our Street Fighter, Puzzle Fighter challenge.
Yep, and we will see who prevails.
Mm-hmm. We had a first match today. I won the first one, and we will do another first to 100, and we'll see if the trophy changes rooms after that. Indeed. Mm-hmm. It's in my studio right now. So it's a nice trophy.
Where would it go for me if I won it?
Living room?
Over the fireplace?
Yeah. Yeah, that would make sense. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's season two begins.
It begins.
Yes, yes. We'll see. We'll see if this is as dramatic as season one.
What?
I'll just keep going.
I was so waiting for you to say something. You like open your mouth to say something. And
I did.
You just like just mysteriously closed your mouth. And
well, I opened my mouth to keep talking, and then I realized I didn't know what I was going to say. And I was like, well, I can't just say words if I don't know what they're going
to
be.
And then you gestured like you were about to type the time code on your little iPad so that you could clip out the ensuing silence.
That was the plan, yeah. But then it's like, you know what, let's just roll with it here. I'm not one for editing, typically.
You know, there was once a famous poet who said, words are very unnecessary.
Isn't that, words are very unnecessary? Is it Depeche Mode?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the famous poets, Depeche Mode.
I think that that's no more appropriate than in this medium of podcasting that... frankly, words are just unnecessary. So if you'd like to do a little experiment where we just don't have words in this podcast.
I got to cut in here. As a longtime producer and host.
I guess he was wrong. Words are necessary.
Yeah, as a longtime producer and host of podcasts, I got to say, podcasts are pretty much just words.
Words are very necessary.
That's their new theme song. Yes, absolutely.
That's the tagline for a panning stream. Yeah. Words are very underline necessary.
I would argue for literally any podcast that words are completely necessary.
Unless it's a
song, and then it's just music.
Right.
Podcast is just the words.
I was hoping I would come up with something as I was saying something.
No,
that's why
there's
I was
no podcast.
So slowly.
No, there's no word podcast.
Whenever I'm in like a Zoom call and someone asks me something and I don't know how to respond, I just end up talking really slowly so I could work out the thought as I'm talking.
Really?
And just hoping that like it's like you're laying out the steps as you walk.
Yeah. That's you can always tell when there's a like young wrestler who's learning the art of the promo and stuff. There's little tricks where it's like, you know, if you're a heel, you can just, you know, if you're trying to get your words together, just shut up to the crowd, you know, do one of those while you're getting your words together. Or you'll see this one a lot, babyface or heel, where, you know, they're doing the promo and then it's like, ha ha. Like a lot of like just like laugh and like rubbing the hands, like, getting the words together.
You know what I don't like when they do this in promos is when they try to act really exasperated and they just like repeat themselves like, I'm tired of all of this, blah, blah, blah. I saw this and I fought him and blah, 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 blah. You know what I mean? When
they just
keep repeating the first word of their sentence because they're so exasperated.
It's a lot for
a dramatic effect.
Yeah, it's a lot of anger and drama when the interpersonal fightings of the wrestlers. Mm-hmm. Indeed, yes.
It's very dramatic and highly personal.
Yeah. Do you want to cut a promo?
Ash man. What? what should I cut a promo on?
Asses. You know, all the great ones started with, you know, Austin 316 says.
All right. So everyone here is talking about asses, ass this, ass that. But have you ever thought about exactly what comes out of those butts? It ain't sunflowers and daisies, ladies and gentlemen. It's poop. People are always talking about back that ass up, shake that ass up. But do you know that poop comes out of those butts? Do you know that people are pooping with their butts? Do you know that they sit on a toilet, which is just a bowl where the poop and pee goes? Oh. And they'll sit there for at least an hour every week pooping. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, look at that healthy butt shaking in the wind.
Shake it.
Yeah, you know, sometimes if I sneeze really hard or cough or just accidentally hit something while I'm walking, my whole body will jiggle and shake. Do you know that, Daniel? Sure. And especially
typically
my
don't
posterior.
Ask questions to the crowd in a promo, but go on.
Especially my posterior will shake because it's like a healthy rump roast. And frankly, if I were on a deserted island with you and I were to die, I would suggest my dying breath, Daniel, please take this healthy rump roast attached to my buttock and make a delicious meal out of it. That's all I'm saying. Yes, I mentioned earlier how disgusting it is because poop comes out of it. But if you think about it, poop only really comes out of the little hole. The actual butt makes for a delicious meal. And I'm talking about the cheeks now. It's 100% certified Wagyu beef in those cheeks. And you can fillet them over an open fire, spit roast those motherfuckers, make a nice ragu with some of my bone marrow and blood. There's endless combinations. And I highly recommend my posterior. And yeah, what? take that, Mr. Champ. I'm going to take that belt off you and whip it against your butt. All you want to talk about is butts. This is my promo.
I was going to ask, you know, when you were done, I was going to ask what we're trying to sell tickets to here, because you were just talking about your butt for a while, and the purpose of a promo is selling tickets and putting butts in seats.
Well, you know, but that my promo was done because I said, this is my promo.
That's true. But at the end, you did turn it around and say you were going to whip the champ's butt, so I do see you made that connective tissue there.
Yeah,
so.
I'll admit, it was less a promo, more just rambling about just the concept of butts, and then my butt specifically, and then consuming my butt as a last resort.
Well, they say the promo is in the eye of the beholder. So, you know, like that's, and you said that is your promo. So it is.
More like the eye of the bowl holder, because you're always pooping in that bowl with the butt that you have that everyone's like, oh, butts. Yeah, butts. Let's sing about butts. Oh, man, look, I'm pointing at that lady's butt because it's so big. It's disproportionately large for her small thighs and tummy. I don't understand how that works, but damn, that's a butt. Oh, man, butts every Sunday. Going to Butt Central taking the highway straight over there. I don't care about any tolls. I'll pay a lot of money to get into Butt Central. Let me tell you what, I'd sacrifice my firstborn. Take it. I just want the butts. Take the baby. Give me the butts. That's just like that famous quote from The Godfather. Take the baby. Leave the butt.
Oh, man. Is that still the promo?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's all in the promo. Got it. Okay. Okay, let me see if I can pull this one off. Well, you know, like the promos such as what you just heard are meant to sell tickets, of course. And you know what else has to sell tickets? That's right. The carnival. That's right. We see a little taste. This is the most natural transition.
Carny bullshit.
That is what this movie is about, is carny bullshit.
Yeah.
That's right. The movie is Nightmare Alley.
Alley.
Did I say it like that?
A little bit. I exaggerated.
Okay. You said it. Nightmare Alley. Mm-hmm. Nightmare Alley from Guillermo del Toro.
Guillermo del Toro. Mm-hmm.
This is only the second year. I have a hair in my mouth.
World is it visible? How's the ball?
Guillermo del Toro. This is the second of his films I've seen. How about you? How many have you seen?
What was the first one?
Pacific Rim.
Okay. I think I've seen two. I've definitely seen Pan's Labyrinth. Obviously this. I'm trying to think if he did that Frida Kahlo movie. Maybe he did not.
I don't think he did. I just did a quick scan of his filmography, and I don't remember the Frida one. Is that the Salma Hayek one with she's got the mm-hmm. eyebrows? Yeah. I don't think I saw that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know why I thought that, but yeah, just two for me as well then, I suppose.
Okay. You like Pan's Labyrinth?
I did.
That's the crazy eye hand thing, right?
I saw it when I was very young, but yes, I did like it.
He was, my understanding is he does a lot of like supernatural type stuff, right?
I think
so. In his filmography, like that's
a
staple.
The Shape of Water and...
Right. Yeah. Hellboy. That's like a comic book thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, and Pacific Rim is like kind of a Godzilla kaiju type thing. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of waiting for that because like not knowing too much of his whole deal, I was waiting for it to get supernatural. And this movie, Nightmare Alley, does not turn supernatural at all. It deals with mentalism, a lot of like, you know, cold reading type stuff, which I always think is a fascinating concept because it's obviously a skill to be able to do it and be like, I don't believe any kind of actual like, you know, super like ability or psychic, you know, powers or anything like that. I just think it's very talented. Mm-hmm. Carnies, basically. And which is interesting because, like, you know, my mom went to a live crossing over thing with, remember that guy, John Edwards?
Oh, boy.
From that South Park Greatest Douche in the Universe episode. And it's really interesting because I've always, you know, been highly suspect of his stuff. And he just seems like a carny who's very good at that stuff and convincing people. And I've always thought it is like him kind of preying on, you know, people. They want to, you know, think of their relatives in a good place and the relatives are talking to them through these mediums. And like, I think it's a little shittier with him because he is specifically kind of preying on that loss and grief and, mm-hmm. And trying to give people hope and things like that through bullshit, you know? Yeah. And it happened, you know, my mom talked to me and she was absolutely convinced, you know, that he was in touch with, I guess technically it would have been my step grandpa who had passed away recently. And my mom was just absolutely convinced, was just like, look, there is no way he would have known this stuff. He absolutely was saying these specific things and just talk like I could tell talking to my mom how much she believed it. And that's a testament to like, this guy is really, really good at this type of thing. But mm-hmm. it doesn't take away from me thinking that, like, it's kind of shitty. And they even say in this movie, there's mentions, like, Bradley Cooper is the lead here, and he plays a mentalist, that he's kind of like, well, I'm just giving people hope. Like, what's the problem with that, you know?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the the ability to communicate with, like, you know, the spiritual world or whatever. I mean, I think the spiritual world is bullshit, but like that idea that you could communicate with the dead and stuff is total bullshit. But there is undeniably a skill in being able to, you know, present that.
And, oh, yeah.
And convincingly present that and, you know, enrapture an audience. And especially if you're able to do that with people who are like skeptical or whatever. And, you know, I think that there is definitely value in the experience insofar as it's just like a cool, different thing to do. But there's absolutely no actual value in what they're saying for sure. But yeah, it's interesting how Bradley Cooper's character evolves throughout the movie as like this excuse me, he's introduced as this guy with this mysterious past, kind of down on his luck, like very mysterious. That opening scene was like very like, you don't really know exactly what's going on, except that he seems to be burying a body and burning a house.
Yeah, they. I really like how they do that, because it's clearly something with his father, and they come back to it several times, but they don't ever explicitly talk about what the relationship is like. Like, he clearly hates his father. He burnt the house down with the father in it, I believe. Or no, he buried the dad.
He buried the dad in the floorboards. And
Right. So, yeah, burnt him down, but, like, sat there and watched him freeze to death, we see in, like, a later thing. But, like, it's just these very brief flashbacks, and never has this whole, like, you know, sorrowful soliloquy about, oh, you know, the relationship. Like, I thought that was really cool the way they did that.
Yeah, I mean, that opening scene, you don't know that it's his father that he's wearing. Yeah, it's just, you could actually even barely tell it's Bradley Cooper.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
You're John Chespagon.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
But he turns up at the carnival after, I guess, just sleeping on the bus. And he, you know, starts there just doing work around the carnival, and then gets together with Xena, who's like the, mentalist, psychic lady who's played by, what's her name?
Toni Collette.
Toni Collette.
She's awesome in this.
She's great. She's great and everything.
Yeah.
She has one of those bathhouses that remind me of Red Dead Redemption 2, where it's like, what's the deal? Is it like a bath, or is it like a prostitution situation? Because why would you need someone to wash you like you're a child, you know?
Yeah, was that a thing back then? Because, like, or maybe it's a thing, like, you know, nowadays it's like, you know, massage parlors and stuff are a very, you know, legit thing. Like, massages are great and everything. But I think that you also hear about the ones that are like, okay, this is kind of the front. We're saying it's a massage thing, but it's actually, you go in, you can pay this, whatever. So I wonder if that was what it was like back then, where it's like bathhouses were a real thing, but then there are ones where it's like, you know, people that were looking for it would be like, hey, go to this one. They'll give you the special treatment or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, bathhouses, especially in like the 70s and 80s in New York City, were definitely a place people would just go to fuck people.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah, for
sure. Was that like during like the Deuce? Like, I remember you watched that.
Yeah,
is that, like,
yeah,
during that era?
Was very prevalent in that show. But yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I wouldn't want to take a bath in front of another person I didn't know, let alone have her wash me.
Yeah.
But anyway, even if it was Toni Collette, but they kind of have this weird, it's suggestion of a romance in the beginning. They start making out, but it doesn't really go anywhere.
I think it's in the book or the original movie, because there was a book in like 1946 and there was like a movie in 1947. And as I was reading up on it, in one of those, it's more explicit that she has been, you know, unfaithful on a regular basis with different guys. Mm-hmm. And that is what drove her husband to like alcoholism and kind of his despair and things like that, which we do see him being kind of an alcoholic, and he's sleeping underneath the stage where they do their act and stuff. So, like, clearly there's something going on with their relationship where he's not happy and she's, you know, but they don't drill down too hard into it in this, you know, we just see a quick scene of it.
Yeah. It's an important distinction that, like, this is based on the novel, a 1946 novel, and there was a film adaptation in the 40s as well, but this isn't a remake of the movie. This is like a new adaptation of the book.
Yeah. Which I want to touch on that when we talk about the ending, because it sounds like this was way more faithful to the book, but we'll get to that. I really liked this early carnival stuff. It's weird. As someone who never really went to carnivals, or, like, you know, I went to the occasional county fair or state fair, but, like, it's not like it was a huge thing for me, but I just kind of like the idea of it. I think, you know, it's just big, loud entertainment, and also the idea of, like, kind of this mystery of, like, okay, how is this game rigged against the player? And, like, how do you get it to the right point where it's, like, enough people can win enough to give people hope, and they'll see someone walking around with a big bear or whatever, but, like, ultimately it's just going to eat your money up. And then, you know, just how are these things? You always suspect a certain level of rigged to these things. And I find that kind of fascinating. Or like you'll see the guys who have to guess your age or your weight and things like that. And, you know, there's got to be little tricks going into that. Like that type of thing is fascinating. And like they even touch on a little bit of like, you know, kind of this is the origins of professional wrestling was like in carnivals where it's like you would have the strong man. He would like, you know, basically tell, you know, I'll fight any man in the crowd and stuff like that. It kind of touches on all that stuff. You've got the strong man, Ron Perlman here. So it's showing all these aspects of like that classic carnival, which I've always found kind of fascinating. Even like the term mark and everything comes from these days. And
yeah, you know? There's definitely like a super seedy, nefarious side to it. Like with the geek guy who is essentially this drug addict, alcoholic that they're holding captive and like barely feeding. And just he's an addict and that's why he's there. I guess they give him his fix. But he's this like, you know, the way they sell it is, is he beast or is he man? And he goes out and he bites off the head of a chicken like Ozzy Osbourne style. And it's really sad and gross.
Well, and the explanation of it by Willem Dafoe, he's just so Willem Dafoe works at the carnival and he's explaining, you know, the geek stuff to Bradley Cooper. Basically, he hires Bradley Cooper to like help take care of the geek and stuff like that. And he's just so matter of fact and cold about it where he's like, yeah, I don't know, he's a junkie. And, you know, you just got to start putting a drop of opium in his thing and, you know, he'll get more dependent. Like he's so knowing of what he's doing that that's what makes it so cold, that he's just explaining it clear as day that like we're doing this awful thing and basically keeping this guy captive and addicted and all that to make a buck. Like it's Defoe's awesome in his role here.
Yeah. It's you know, there's a certain degree of manipulation with like every single showcase or presentation in the carnival. But like with that, it's especially dark because they're essentially keeping someone prisoner by holding him captive through his dependency and everything. But yeah, so they have like the Xena, Toni Collette, like mentalist stuff, and they show how it's done with like a glass window on the stage and everything. So
I love that.
See, yeah, it was really interesting. And they do a good job of like planting the seeds of, you know, Bradley Cooper's character is really curious about this mentalist stuff, and Pete, Xena's husband, like they had this running show throughout like Paris or something where they figured out this like language signals and stuff to where they can kind of communicate with each other about the mark or whatever without actually saying words. So it seemed really legit.
Coded language and stuff. Yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah. And, but Pete essentially warns Cooper that like, listen, don't go down this road. It's extremely dangerous. Like they make a big deal about like, don't take it too far to the point where people actually think that you're communicating with the dead or you're giving them hope or something like that, because they always call that, they refer to it throughout the movie as like a spook show. Cause that will like get people thinking about like the other quote unquote other side and like the dead people coming back and giving them false hope essentially.
Yeah. And that's why I almost wondered if this was going to go supernatural in that degree of like, is it going to go into like ghost afterlife stuff, or is like the geek going to be like a monster type thing? Is this going to be about him like getting loose and something awful happening? But like, no, it's just dark carnival shit, honestly. Mm-hmm. Not dark carnivals in like ICP, but you know, dark carnival stuff. This stuff was really cool. I even loved how like at one point the cops get called on the carnival and they know at the carnival that like the geek stuff is the super illegal stuff. So they have like a fake banner that shows like, oh, it's like a petting zoo that goes over the geek thing. Like I thought that was so cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Rooney Mara plays Molly. And she works at the carnival. And she is, as far as I can tell, her gimmick is she gets electrocuted.
Yeah.
And was there a real gimmick to it? Or is it like, because she talks later on about how it's like, it was actually like hurting her, right?
Yeah. She just knows how much she can take before she can. Yeah, it seems like, I figured initially that it had to be like gimmicked in some way, but it seems like it was like to an extent actually electrocuting her.
Yeah, it'd be a hard one to gimmick because like you see the bolts like going through her skin and stuff like that. So yeah, that seems like a shitty job at the carnival.
Yeah, of all the shitty jobs, it seems like that one's really bad.
Yeah. I don't think I've seen her in anything before.
Rooney Mara?
Yeah, was she in the girl with the dragon tattoo stuff? Like was she in the one with Daniel Craig, like the American or the Western version? Or because there was like a Denmark version or a Norway version or something, right?
Yeah. Yeah, she was. And she was also in that movie Side Effects with Catherine Zeta-Jones and Channing Tatum. It was a good movie.
Okay.
She's in a few things. She has that like kind of doe-eyed porcelain gothic look to her.
Yeah.
So she was very well suited for this role.
Definitely. Actually, the whole cast here is incredible because it's like, so we got Bradley Cooper, Stan Carlisle, Kate Blanchett, we're going to get to in a second, Rooney Mara as Molly, Toni Collette as Xena, and Tony, Pete, and Defoe, like they're kind of just in this carnival part of the beginning, which I really like how there are distinct acts in this. I feel like there's this carnival part is the first act, and then the second act is kind of, we'll get to it, but Bradley and, or, you know, the characters on the road doing their thing. And then there's this last kind of grift they do, which it feels like three very distinct parts of the movie, which I like.
Yeah, it's like a three act play.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, Defoe, Ron Perlman is the strong man, Bruno. David Strathairn is Pete. And I have seen him in a million things. I think he's just a big character actor because I feel like I've seen him for decades.
But I agree. Yeah, I've definitely seen him, but his name definitely eludes me. Like you said his name and I was like, I don't recognize that, but I recognize his face for sure.
Yeah, I'm looking at his filmography now. He did a stuff in the Bourne movies. Yeah, looks like he's got a long filmography. So, but he was really good as Pete in this, I thought.
Pete,
indeed. And Mary Steenburgen even has a brief little thing here as the wife of Judge Kimball. But yeah, so basically the carnival stuff is all in service of showing that Stan is learning these tricks and stuff, which I do think that some things in this movie happen too fast as far as like we don't really see it get earned, where it's like, we see like a scene where he is at Pete and Xena's house and they're kind of explaining the language and stuff. But like there's, I don't need a full fucking Rocky training montage of him learning how to do mentalism stuff. But I think it cut basically from him being kind of curious to him suddenly being a master mentalist, you know?
Yeah, I think the turning point was when the police came and he was able to convince the sheriff or whatever that guy, whatever his role is, that, you know, they were that his loved one was around or some shit. He was essentially able to manipulate the sheriff using his quote-unquote mentalist abilities.
Yeah, and even that, I feel like all of a sudden he was too good at that. You know, we didn't even see like a in-between from him being kind of like, oh, what's this? To like, oh, I can totally manipulate the sheriff into thinking this thing. You know, like, I feel just a little bit more could have helped there, I think.
Yeah, I think that there is more of a time jump than, like, they don't explicitly say the time jump, but like, he goes from being a new guy there to like, everyone knows him and he has a relationship with Molly and stuff that, like, that also kind of comes out of nowhere. I mean, like, we see them looking at each other and then all of a sudden they're like dancing on the, carousel and everything and talking about leaving together. So
yeah, it's really not clear how much time elapses there. There is a more clear time jump here at the end of the carnival part where it says like 2 years later. And we see that like they have left, Stan and Molly have left the carnival and now they're doing their like crossing over shtick at like, I think they said like Buffalo, New York is kind of where they're stationed. Like you can tell just in the shift from like, you know, carnival and dirt floors to, you know, they're at like these nice kind of banquet hall type things and putting on like a successful show.
Yeah. Seem to be living in like a fancy hotel and wearing fancy clothes and, you know, everyone's kind of in awe. Like the clientele is like well dressed and, and not, you know, not the same clientele. So yeah, there's definitely an implication that he's, experiencing a lot of success and starts to attract the interest of powerful people.
Yeah, including, so this is where Kate Blanchett comes in as Dr. Ritter. And so she's a psychologist and there's Judge Kimball, who's a judge. So yeah, judges and psychologists are there. You know, this is, they're all dressed up, like you said. And I thought this was a really cool scene here because we see a little bit of them working different crowds and stuff. And then all of a sudden, Dr. Ritter, Kate Blanchett, basically tries to expose him. And he, again, being extremely good at this, was able to like, best her, I guess, in this and like win the crowd over and things like that. And so that makes this judge, Judge Kimball, be like, oh, I want to get you to help us communicate with our dead son. And so it's him and Mary Steenburgen.
Well, hiring, basically. I mean, the thing is, like, he doesn't know about the dead son, but Kate Blanchett, being a doctor who records all of her sessions, she has information on these powerful clients that aren't common knowledge. So she kind of works with Stan to, you know, put one over on these powerful people. And so it works with the judge, but ultimately it doesn't really work out because when Stan is talking to Mary Steenburgen, who plays the judge's wife, he talks about, you know, the son who passed away in war, like wanting everyone to be together again. And she kind of interprets that as like, oh, well, we should probably all die now.
Right. And
she, there's like a murder suicide. It's pretty shocking.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So in that relationship with the judge and then kind of this working relationship with Dr. Ritter leads to this guy, Ezra Grindel, who is this like super, super rich guy that people are warning him, like, he's really fucking dangerous. Like, be careful about this guy. I think it's even Dr. Ritter that is telling him like, hey, be careful about this dude. Which there's a scene too where Dr. Ritter analyzes Stan, and like that's a really interesting one where she is kind of like doing that, like, reading of him where it's like, hey, the way you winced when I offered you alcohol and the way you do this, like I can tell, you know, you've got a bad relationship with your father and he was probably an alcoholic and this type of stuff. And so she is like bringing up the stuff that he clearly is trying to like shove back into his head and not acknowledge.
Yeah. And they also end up having like an affair together.
Yeah.
He like, I think it's heavily implied that he has issues with, obviously, like father issues, but issues with women as well, because every woman that he seems to interact with, he ends up getting it on with to some extent.
Yeah, yeah, like every woman, you know, including Molly, mm-hmm. who's the one he's like married to mm-hmm. and doing this act with. Yeah. So yeah, this Grindel stuff, like Molly seems like she doesn't want any part of this because she's kind of like heeding the warnings of being like, I don't know, this sounds like too much. We shouldn't do this with this right. guy.
Yeah, because he, you know, they always warned him about getting into like the spook show territory, and now he's like actually having, it's not a show anymore. Now he's having private consultations with people where there's no audience. It's just him and the client, and, you know, he's, you know, essentially acting like he's a conduit to the people that they lost, and it's extremely manipulative and really shitty.
With powerful people that could, like, if this goes bad, it could go real bad. Like, you're showing up and having to take lie detector tests while these big bodyguards with guns are, like, looking over you and, like...
Yeah, when he walks into Ezra Grindel's house or whatever, you recognize, like, what he's gotten himself into, because this is, like, a... not just a rich person's house, but, like, a castle type of situation.
Yeah, and the guy, I love this actor. He was in Fight Club, he was in Wrath of Man, he was like the cop, like the dirty cop. He's just that big kind of stern faced guy. He plays Ezra Grindel's main bodyguard, Anderson.
Yeah,
he's always really good at that role of just like, oh, you seem like you're a maybe bad guy and could fuck someone up.
Yeah, he's great in Mindhunter as well.
Oh, really?
You've seen that on Netflix. You would really like that show.
Yeah,
yeah, it's really
good. I love that actor. He's great.
He's awesome in it, and it's kind of a different role for him because it's he plays a detective, but it's more like they're psychoanalyzing serial killers and stuff. It's
it's cool,
really interesting.
Huh.
Yeah, he's great. And so yeah, the Ezra guy's like super intimidating, and he clearly has some terrible thing burdening him that he needs to get off his chest. And Dr. Lilith eventually reveals that, like, or I think actually Stan sneaks into her office and listens to the tape of their sessions, and he finds out that, like, he had that Ezra had like forced an abortion on his, I don't know if his first wife or lover or whatever.
Yeah, Dory is like the one that he's trying to, because she died from that forced abortion. Mm-hmm. That's why he hires Stan, is to like try to conjure her back up, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a preposterous idea for someone who's clearly as successful as this dude to believe that there is, you know, a world in which his deceased lover could be materialized is very perplexing.
Well, and that's why I love, like, the dynamic between him and, like, Anderson, the bodyguard, because he's just so desperate and guilt-ridden and everything that he's like, oh, I just need to conjure her up. I need mm-hmm. to make this happen. And Anderson is just, like, incredibly skeptical to the point where it's like, if Ezra's not in the room, Anderson will talk to Bradley Cooper and just be like, hey, this is fucking bullshit. Yeah. And, like, I got my eye on you. Like, I love that thing where it's like, hey, I got to protect my boss, and my boss wants this, but, like, I can see through you. Like, yeah. That was cool.
And Stan even, like, doesn't even pretend around Anderson, too. He, like, just acts kind of like an asshole in front of him. You know?
Yeah.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, it's ultimately, you know, it's pretty obvious it's not going to end well.
Yeah.
It's
like he tries to dress Molly up because he finds pictures of Dory and he's like, hey, it looks like you. She's got dark hair. So why don't we just put a bunch of blood on your hands and near your, you know, crotch, and we'll have you walk out in a white dress and just stay far away. It'll mm-hmm. be fine. And like, As we're watching this, it's so clear this is not going to go well.
It's well, you know it's not going to go well because he explains in detail what the plan is to her in the car before they get out. And whenever someone explains a plan in a movie, it's never going to go that way.
Yeah, and she is understandably like, hey, fuck this. Like, and I think at this point she's found out that he's cheating, and mm-hmm. she's like, okay, I'm going to do this last thing, but then I'm done. And she even talks about, like, back when I did the electric thing, I knew when I had had enough, and I had to stop, and it's like, I've had enough here, you know? So I do like this thing of, like, her being like,
one more, then I'm out, mm-hmm. you know? So yeah, it goes bad immediately. Like Ezra realizes it's not Dory because he runs up and like hugs her and looks in her face and is like, who the fuck are you? And this is at the same time that Anderson, the bodyguard, hears about the murder suicide of the judge, mm-hmm. On the radio when he comes out to check, sees what's going on and just gets brutal here.
Oh my God. Yeah. You made a really good point after we were done watching it, how like the movie doesn't have a lot of violence in it, but when it does, it's like very shocking because it's very realistic and very brutal. But, Stan essentially beats Ezra's face to a pulp.
Like, his nose is gone.
Face is just, there's just nothing there. He's dead. And then as him and Molly escape, they run over Anderson on the way out.
Oh, Anderson's like on the ground and like lifts his head up and just gets plastered by this car. Like it really does make violence in movies stand out so much more, where it's like, you know, if it's like a Rambo movie, you're used to seeing someone die, you know, one of the later Rambo movies all the time. But this one, it's like, those are the two points of like major violence I can think of. Mm-hmm. And both of them are like, oh fuck. Like it hits you, you know,
for sure.
Yeah. So they trash the car, you know, he tries to make it look like, you know, sets it on fire and everything. And Molly leaves him. And then it just all goes to hell. Mm-hmm. Everything just goes to hell for Stan. Like it starts with the next thing, he goes to Dr. Ritter, right? For the money.
Right. And then he realizes that she was just manipulating him the whole time. Like all the dollars she replaced with like singles. And, you know, she obviously has a, accomplished psychologist is able to just summon the security guards and kind of frame him with no one suspecting her at all.
And even records a thing that mm-hmm. like implicates him of like, you know, and she's like, oh, that's not what happened. What are you talking? Like basically she's covering her tracks in a smart way and like outwitting this guy who has made an entire life and living like outwitting people, right. Which I thought was a really cool turn.
Yeah. It was seemed like it was less about the money for her and more just like, fuck you to this guy who's manipulating people. Mm-hmm. She was skeptical, highly skeptical of him from the jump. So he runs away and he ends up getting on a train. And
he gets shot in the ear.
Oh yeah, that's gross. And yeah, he ends up like living like a pauper for a while before he finds his way back to the carnival, and things come full circle. And like the cruel irony, where he goes to try to get a job as a mentalist at the carnival, but like instead the carnival boss, I don't know.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, you can't do that, but I do have a job for you.
And he stresses the temporary part of it, which Willem Dafoe told him at the beginning, like, that's what you gotta do. You gotta tell him it's temporary, really stress that part. And like, he's just, it's seeing the exact same grift play out here and knows it.
Yeah.
You know?
And then Stan, it's like one of the best scenes in the movie, or one of the best frames of the movie, is when he's like cackling. It's like, I was born for it. You know what I mean? That's such a great, Bradley Cooper is really extraordinary in this movie. And the cinematography is amazing. The color play is so good. There's so many really beautiful scenes where like there's the contrast between light and dark and the use of light to frame faces and stuff. It's like very film noir vibes with, you know, not only the time period, but just like the plot itself. I mean, you have like the femme fatale with Cate Blanchett and like just, you know, all these dark manipulations and stuff and scheming. It was a great movie.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. And at first I was a little skeptical because I think I don't like Bradley Cooper, but I think that's just because like I associate him with like the stuff you hear about him in or see him the most. And it's like these hangover movies that I think are just kind of dopey and dumb. But then I forget that he's actually a really good actor. Like A Star Is Born, he was really good in, and he directed that, didn't he?
Oh, did he?
Yeah, I think he did. And I don't think I've seen him in enough stuff. And so I think I'm quick to forget that he's not just the dopey hangover guy and he's actually really good. So and the novel had the same dark ending as this. So that had the thing where he realized it. And he's like, oh, mister, I was made for it. But the 1947 movie got changed to make it more upbeat, where he basically like, you know, he gives Molly money and says, okay, return to the carnival. And they wind up working at the same carnival. And he's the geek for a little bit. But then she like reconciles with him and they turn things around. And it's like, that sounds like some fucking studio getting in there and be like, ah, we got to send the crowd home happy. You know, like
all it needs is a Blade Runner voiceover and it'd be good to go.
Yeah, that's a great, great comparison. Yeah. Yeah, I love this too. I think my only kind of complaint that I had a few times is I kind of alluded to it earlier. He became that incredible mentalist so fast. He very quickly after like things went south, it's just like, oh, he's just a hobo now, just, you know, drinking around a fire with a bunch of, you know, boxcar dwelling guys and stuff like that. And then it's like him just being like totally okay with being like, yeah, okay, I'll be the chicken eating geek or whatever. Like I felt like it all happened. I like where the story went with every one of those beats. I just feel like there wasn't enough
getting to each one of those. It's just like very quick, like, okay, now this is fine, you know, like, or this is where I'm at. But it's a minor complaint because honestly, like, the story and the path that character goes on, I think, is so interesting. And the way Del Toro kind of frames everything, like you were saying, is incredibly well done.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, like, he, you know, when you see that scene where he's, it's really cruel. His dad is this old decrepit guy, and we don't know what kind of guy his dad was. Not that it matters. Like, he's this decrepit guy on a bed, and Bradley Cooper's character takes his blanket off the guy and just watches him kind of freeze to death.
Yeah, there's a close-up on his face where whoever plays that old guy really sells it well. And I was thinking, like, you know, it's implied, probably. Like, it's easy to assume that he was a terrible guy. Mm-hmm. And, but, like, no matter how bad someone is, it's kind of hard to just watch someone at feeble old age just, like, in such pain and, like, you know, no matter how bad they were, it's just kind of like, oh, this is, like, sad to see, you
especially
know?
When it's like just it's such an easily mitigated suffering, like, just put the blanket back on him, you know. It's just cruel. So, you know, he's a cruel guy. He manipulated people for power and money. He's a cheater. It all comes full circle when he ends up being the geek and he kind of gets his comeuppance that way. So in my opinion, it was really dark but satisfying ending.
No, it was incredibly well done. I went in not knowing anything, and that was fun too, because, like, I really was expecting for the first, like, half hour or more, like, oh, this is going to be like a supernatural turn or something like that, and the fact that they didn't, and it just thematically, I think it just worked from beginning to end. Big thumbs up, I would say.
Yeah it's great. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah That is Nightmare Alley. We watched it on HBO Max. I think I saw it might be on Hulu as well, so you might be able to check it out there. But just do a little Google there and you can figure out where it's at. But thanks for the recommendation, Bonk. That was a lot of fun.
Of course.
Yes. I want to give a special shout out to all of our patrons out there.
Shout out.
Yes, that is we are shouting you out for joining us on our
patron!
One easy... You hear that? That was the shout out for joining our one simple $5 tier. Gets you ad-free episodes.
Wow.
Gets you access to the Discord.
Wow.
Gets you early episodes.
Wow.
And gets For You, written for you by Bonk. Your own custom Bonku. Bonk, do we have someone this week?
We sure do, Daniel.
Who do we got?
This week, we are honoring our friend Devin.
Devin, thank you.
Devin, if you're out there, if this is percolating your adorable little ear holes, I hope it goes in through your ear holes, tickles your brain, and puts a smile on your cutie pie face.
Brain's going to get tickled.
This Bonku is for you. My blood turned to ice when Devin's eyes pierced through me and murdered my soul.
So this is nothing he could be convicted for.
I don't know.
Soul murder.
Depends on the jury, I guess.
It's not on the books. You can murder someone's souls. Is that, like, a good thing in terms of, like, you're, like, taken aback by, like, my goodness?
Is murdering a soul a good thing?
I mean, what does that mean? Does that mean that you're just, like, scared? Or does that mean you're, like, enraptured?
You know, I craft these Bonkus with great care, and then for you to just scream, what does that mean?
Well, I'm just thinking out loud. You don't have to tell me. I don't, you know, what art is in the eye of the, like, or what artist's intent, or that's a whole thing, right?
Farts are in the eye of the bowl holder.
And with that, that'll be our episode for this week. You bookended it. You got the butts up top, you got the farts at the end there. Nice work. Fartist. Man, we got some good material here. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Bonk, thank you so much for joining me each and every week. And we will see you all next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.